Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
For our friends listening on the internet, we are continuing tonight in the book of Judges, and then next week and the week after, we will be off. GCA will be dark next week and the week after because there will be kids out of school and then it's the Wednesday between the holidays. And so every year we take 2 weeks off right around this time. And Christmas and New Year's both fall on weekends and Sundays this year just to make things even more complicated. So let there be no question, GCA will be open for business Christmas morning. I've gotten email from folks who have asked and said, our church is going to be closed for Christmas. Will you be open? Yeah, that's what I, of course, some of these people were in Portland, Oregon, but, you know, yeah, come out to GCA. It's a short commute. Come on out. So, yes, unlike some other churches, we will be open Christmas morning. So get up early, open your packages, drink your eggnog, have whatever fun you're going to have, and then get in the car and get over here at 10:30. That's right. Now, if you drink a lot of eggnog, don't come to church Sunday morning.
You might have a raucous meeting.
Exactly. Don't be sloshing in here with Merry Christmas or something, but we will be here that morning, December 25th. We will also be here a week later, despite the fact that that is New Year's. We will be here. So plan accordingly. Even if I'm the only person here, I'll just talk to Tom, because he'll be here. So, no pressure.
I've got nowhere to go.
Exactly. That's my life right there. People laugh when I say, you know, oh, I'm going to go a little long because I have nowhere to be. And they think, oh, he probably has somewhere to be. No, he doesn't. He has nowhere to be. We are in the book of Judges, so turn to the book of Hebrews. Yeah, I know. Last week, I kind of introduced the fleece idea, which is upcoming now in the book of Judges, and that's what we're going to see tonight. And I very much like the whole story because even as a young Lutheran kid, that story inspired me to go before God and sort of lay my fleece before him, even though my fleece was slightly different. I couldn't put my hands on any lamb's wool, But it encouraged me, even as a young person, as a young believer, to know that I could go before God and say, really? Because this is just a really interesting juxtaposition of concepts that we see here between the book of Judges and, say, the book of Job. Job questioned God, and he gets quite upset. And yet here we see Gideon say to God, really? Was it really you? Do you really want me to do this? Is this really the plan? And God answers him. And God doesn't just answer him once. God answers him with an angel who then does the miracle of burning up the food that he's brought out. And then the angel disappears. And then Gideon asks again and puts the fleece out. And it all works out the way he described. And then Gideon says, you know, 2 out of 3. We're going to go one more time around, puts it out one more time, and yet again, God responds to him. Well, what this shows me is the remarkable patience of God when he's dealing with, in this case, Gideon, because God works with individuals. God does not work with everybody on just an even plane where he responds to everybody exactly the same way. He knows who you are. He knows what you're like. He knows your personality. He knows your shortcomings. He knows your capacity. He knows how much faith he's given you. He knows how much perseverance he's given you. And he knows that there are just going to be some people who, like, come to the doctrines of grace, let's say. And the first time they hear total depravity, they go, well, yeah, of course. And, well, it's, you know, election is completely unmerited and not based on anything except God's choice. And they go, well, of course. And limited atonement, it's limited to those people that God, well, yes, of course, it's the only way it could be. How about irresistible grace? I'm on board. Perseverance of the saints? Absolutely. Some people just get it. I got the God is sovereign thing, but struggled for a couple of years with the limited atonement thing. It took a while for me to really get a hold of that, and it was my great friend David Morris who convinced me of it before I ever met him or knew his name. And so God knew that. God knew that I was the kind of hard-headed person who was going to need evidence and convincing, and because I have to think through things, I have to process things. And he knew that about me, and he was very patient with me. He was patient with me all through my rock and roll rebellion years. After being brought up in the church and after my running away from the church and running away from everything that smacked of Christianity, God would have been well within his rights to say, well, you had your shot, and now we're done here, drummer boy. But he didn't. He was quite patient with me, waited till I got a good whiff of myself, waited till I got really sick of myself and my own ego. And then once I was in his good providence, driven back down to the place he wanted me, he then met me right there and began the process of teaching and instructing and building me back up. But it took tearing me down in order to build me back up. Now, that's not how he did it necessarily with Job. When Job said, you know, if God was here, I would demand some answers, God shows up and says, you don't know anything. Who is this that darkens my counsel without knowledge? And of course, he does that for Job's three friends as well, because of their philosophizing about what God was like. And of course, God ends up saying that he's not going to accept a sacrifice from them because they did not say that which was right about him. Well, for heaven's sake, in my life, I've said a lot of things about God that weren't right. And God was patient with me and kind with me and instructive with me and brought me along like a father and handled me like a teacher. And so that's what we really see in Gideon and what's happening in Gideon. He does not start out mighty man of valor, even though the angel of the Lord shows up and says, mighty man of valor. And his response is, not me. Yeah, I know. Look at me. I'm the least in my father's house, and we're the least of the houses of Israel, and I'm down here on a wine press threshing out a little bit of grain, and this is not mighty man of valor stuff. And yet God called him that, knowing full well that that's what he was going to be. But it was going to take a process to get him from the wine press out there onto the field, leading the armies of Israel and doing it in a brave, courageous, faithful way. That takes progress, that takes time, and it takes God instruction. It takes God's instruction. And I'm very, very grateful that God's that way, because that's how he has dealt with me. And I'm certain that many of you could testify that that's how he's dealt with you. And aren't you glad that he's not the kind of God who just simply says, look, I told you once, and you didn't get it, and that's your fault, and we're done here. That's not the God you're dealing with. You're dealing with a God who knows what you're like. He built you from your inward parts. He knows your thoughts afar off. He knows the things you say before you say them. He chose you knowing this was what you were like, and he will provide in this lifetime everything necessary to carry you along and instruct you to make you into the person he wants you to become. Here, I'll put it another way. Alan, are you different than you were 10 years ago when it comes to your Christian faith? Yeah, sure. I asked because I knew you were. Considerably different than 10 years ago, yeah. But did that happen all at once? No, because God works through the process of time and events. But here's what I know for sure. The person you are now is the person he intended for you to be, not the person you were 10 years ago. That was the person he was still working on. Now you're this person. Between now and whenever he calls you home, he will continue your progress because he still has in mind who he's going to make you and what he's going to make you like. And when you reach that stage, it will be because that was the person that God intended for you to become. God intended for Gideon to be mighty man of valor, but he didn't start there. But God got him there. Now, the reason we're in Hebrews 11, is everybody there? Hebrews 11 is classically called the heroes of faith passage. speaking of the book of Hebrews, a couple weeks ago, two Sundays ago, in fact, as we were closing the book of Titus, I made the comment that I was taking suggestions and voting for whether we move into Galatians or Hebrews. And I said, vote often. And I regret saying that now. I will publicly admit my regret, because the voting has been fast and furious. And so far, it's still neck and neck. It's still Galatians and Hebrews, neck and neck. And so I had someone ask on Facebook the other day, when does the voting close? And I said, when the preaching starts. That's when we'll find out which way it went. Now see, she's voting. She's right there voting. She said, if you start on Hebrews, I won't live long enough to get to Galatians. But we'll just have to see where God leads, even though I have my opinion too.
How many votes do you cast?
The deciding vote. Exactly. I just wanted to see where people's interest was. It's been very encouraging to see how much interest there is. So I said all that to give you time to get to Hebrews 11. Let's start in verse 32. Now he's been going through, the writer of Hebrews has been going through various Old Testament characters and saying, they did this, they did this, they did this. And of course, to the Hebrew audience to which he's writing, they would know these people. These are their forefathers. These are the Old Testament heroes. These are well-known personages in the Old Testament. And the point that he's making over and over again is, yes, they did these heroic exploits. How did they do them? They did them by faith. They did them because they had faith in the God of Israel. They had faith that God was going to deliver them, that God was going to be with them, that God was going to guide and lead and protect them. And so by faith, they did these things. And in verse 32, he says, and what more shall I say? For time will fail me if I tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who by faith conquered kingdoms, performed acts of righteousness, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. From weakness they were made strong, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Well, of course, some of that is directly referring to Gideon, because that's what he and the judges did, drove out the foreign powers and the foreign armies and became mighty in war, mighty man of valor stuff. So how did Gideon, according to the New Testament, according to the writer of Hebrews, how did Gideon do the exploits we're about to read about? Well, he did them by faith. Now, where did he get this faith? This is a very common question that folks ask about the Old Testament folks. They say, well, how did they have this faith? Where would such a faith come from? Chapter 12 answers that question. After going through the litany of different Old Testament heroes of faith, chapter 12 starts with, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, he's talking about the people who are alive as he's writing this, the Hebrew audience to whom he's writing. He says, if you look around, we have this great cloud of witnesses, all the people who went ahead of us, who did all these exploits by faith. They now are surrounding us, watching us live out our journey of faith. And so he says, we have this great cloud of witnesses surrounding us, so let us lay aside every encumbrance. The King James says, lay aside every weight, everything that would weigh you down. And let us lay aside the sin that does so easily entangle us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and, King James says, finisher, NASB says, perfecter of faith. Now, it's no mistake that that statement is appended to the very end of the Heroes of Faith passage. It's too bad that there's a big 12 right there, because the writer of Hebrews is continuing this thought. That is, all these people did these wonderful exploits by faith, and Jesus is the author and finisher of faith. In other words, anywhere that you find faith, anywhere in time or history, anywhere in heaven, anywhere on earth, anytime you see faith, Jesus is the author of it. That means that he instigated it, he began it, he created it, he instills it in people, and he is the perfecter of it. So if you continue in faith, if you do exploits in faith, if you do anything like what anybody in the Heroes of Faith passage did, then it is Jesus who did it. And that's why it's important to remember that even in the Old Testament, the triune God is still at work, all the way back to, say, Genesis, when God spoke and everything that wasn't became. Well, the writer of Hebrews is going to start his book, the book of Hebrews, by hearkening all the way back to Genesis 1, the same way that John does in his gospel, harkens back to Genesis 1 and argues that Jesus was right there, actively the speaking agency of the triunity that brought everything into being. So everything was made by him and for him, and in him all things consist and have their being. So Christ is intimately involved in what's going on in the Old Testament and intimately involved in what's going on in Israel. And that's why he occasionally shows up, why I argue that Melchizedek was a Christophany. Because Jesus keeps showing up at these vital moments in Israel's history and blessing them and continuing them and all that stuff. So what we know for certain about Gideon is that he's listed in the New Testament as one of the heroes of faith. He does great exploits because he has great faith. And the faith that he has is a gift from Jesus, who is the author and finisher of faith. Now, what does Gideon's faith look like when we meet him? Practically non-existent. Sally gave him the Yeah. So my point is, here's what the New Testament authors say about Gideon. He's a great hero of faith. Someone that the New Testament authors could use to point at and say, this is what faith looks like. And Jesus is the author and finisher of faith. And he is one of those people who exemplifies the kind of faith that the author and finisher of faith provides. And yet when we meet him, he's saying, no, not me. I'm just eking out my last meal here, grinding the last of my grain in a wine press so that nobody will find me. I won't go to the threshing floor where they'd expect me to be. And I can't do this. And when the angel of the Lord tells him he's going to, he puts the angel of the Lord to the test. And then he goes and knocks over the altar of Baal and burns down and tears down the Asherah and then puts up an altar to God and calls it Jehovah Shalom. Yahweh is peace. And then he does it all by night. And the next day, which is where the story picks up for us today, the next day, the men come and say, well, who has done this? And he's faced with the reality that he is now separate from his father's house and from all the servants and the men that are angry at him. And so what does he do? He doesn't stand up and say, I'm here to defend the God of Israel. I'm here to defend the right and the reputation of the God that you have offended. No, he goes to God and says, are you sure? But he's a hero of faith. How does he get from the wine press to chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews? He gets there because God takes him there, step by step, bit by bit, because he is, after all, the author and perfecter of faith. And it's not always a straight linear line. Our faith sometimes ebbs and flows. Turn to the book of Judges now. Our faith grows and our faith sometimes struggles and stumbles, but that's why faith across the board, no matter where you find it, is always a gift of God. It is always through Christ, who is the author of faith, and he is the perfecter of it. Now, what else that tells us, by the way, is that faith is indeed a gift. And there are theological arguments aplenty, and we can go around and around for hours arguing about this. But consistently, the New Testament testimony is that faith is a gift from God. Yes, we do believe, but we believe because we've been given the faith to believe. So even though we are believing, we're not believing because we stirred that up in ourselves. Now, Tom and I come out of a church environment where we were told that, you know, there's that little bit of good in everybody, and there's a little bit of faith in everybody, and you just have to stir up your faith. And then you have to take what he called the leap of faith. And when you took that leap of faith, you threw yourself on Christ, and then Christ would accept you because you took that leap, which means that God is essentially waiting for you to take the first step. And if you'll just take that first step, then he'll meet you there. And of course, you've probably heard that a lot in churches that do altar calls and such. They'll say, if you'll just step out into the aisle and take that first step, the Holy Ghost will meet you there and take the rest of the steps with you. Another chorus of Just As I Am, Without One Plea. Let's keep the organ going, come on. Because it's very common for folks to think that God is waiting on us to do something. If we're thinking biblically, if we're thinking consistently with what the Bible actually teaches doctrinally, if God is waiting for us, he will never stop waiting because we're not going to do it. Instead, he has to grant us with the ability. He has to enlighten us. He has to regenerate us. He has to put his Holy Spirit in us. And a gift of the Holy Spirit is faith. When Paul lists the gifts of the Spirit in writing to the Corinthians, he includes faith as a gift. But this is the same Paul who writes and says, by grace are you saved through faith. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9. For by grace are you saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. There's a video out there floating around on the internet that's been out there for a couple of years from some teaching that I had done at the conference in Lexington a few years ago, a segment called Faith is a Gift, if you want to look it up on YouTube. And in it, I show the Greek exegesis to prove that the neuter demonstrative pronoun that in the middle of the sentence, for by grace are you saved through faith, and that is not of yourselves. Because it's neuter, it doesn't match the gender and number of any of the first three words. It doesn't match saved or grace or faith. And so there are plenty of folks who want to argue about that particular verse, by grace are you saved through faith and that. And they'll say, well, faith, that's feminine, and that needs to agree with it if it's referring to that. And it doesn't agree with it in gender and number. Therefore, faith is not the gift. It's the grace and the salvation that's a gift, but the faith, you have to do that. The problem is that neither faith nor grace nor saved match in gender and number with the word that. So Greek grammar tells us that the word that, the demonstrative pronoun, is pointing at the entire phrase. Everything in that phrase is summed up in the word that, which means by grace are you saved through faith, and that is not of yourself. It is a gift of God, not of works, lest anyone should boast. That verse says, as plainly and clearly as any verse you're going to find in the Bible, that faith is a gift. And if faith is a gift, then Jesus is indeed the author and the finisher of faith. And Gideon was the recipient of this marvelous gift of faith. But he didn't start there. He got there. And that, my friends, was all introduction. Okay, good. Wet my whistle and I'll be right with you. Let's check it. Yeah, okay. That was such a sad joke. And I feel sorry for you all that you laughed at it. Oh, nice. One for Alan. Zing. We are in Judges 6, let's start at verse 28. When the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was torn down, and the Asherah, which was beside it, was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar which had been built. And they said to one another, who did this thing? And when they searched about and inquired, they said, Gideon the son of Joash did this thing. Then the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son, that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah, which was beside it. But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. And if he is a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar." That's as far as we got last week, and talked about hesitating between two views, and if God is God, worship him, and if Baal is Baal, worship him. Starting at verse 32 then, "Therefore on that day he," that is Joash, "named him," you'll find out in a minute that that's Gideon, "named him Jerubbaal," which by the way means contender with Baal. So his dad gives him the nickname, the one who fights with Baal, which is just great. That is to say, let Baal contend against him, because he had torn down Baal's altar. "Then all of the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east assembled themselves, and they crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and the Abiezrites were called together to follow him. And he sent messengers through Manasseh, and they also were called together to follow him. And he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. Then Gideon said to God, 'If you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken, behold, do this.'" Now you got to stop and think for a moment. First, the Spirit of the Lord comes upon him. This is God guiding him, directing him, giving him the courage to do this. Now, there appears to be, grammatically and even contextually, seems to be a difference between our New Testament concept of the Spirit, because certainly Jesus made that distinction when he said, speaking of the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, he said, the world doesn't know him, but you'll know him because he'll be with you and he'll be in you. And then, of course, on the day of Pentecost, the Spirit falls and inhabits people in a unique way, where Paul would say that it seals them until the day of their full redemption. In the Old Testament, you see the Spirit of God come upon people sometimes, but the Spirit of God even comes upon King Saul, and he prophesies with the sons of the prophets, and yet there's no indication that this is a saved man. He dies in rebellion against God and apparent apostasy. And yet the Spirit of God was on him for a moment. So this seems to be like an external thing where the Spirit of God comes on somebody to kind of give them the courage, the bravery to do what they need to do. But don't think of it as the same as the infilling of the Holy Spirit that you see in the New Testament. There appears to be a difference there. Yes, Sally. That's my best understanding of it. I mean, I have to admit that there is a certain amount of mystery here, because the Spirit of God certainly came upon David, and he wrote prophetically about Christ so perfectly that Christ even quoted him from the cross. So clearly this is the Spirit of God working in prophecy in order to do that, but there seems to yet be, like I just said, this distinction to the new covenant infilling of the Holy Spirit, because the infilling of the Holy Spirit is the sign and seal of the new covenant. And so you're not going to see that same sign and seal among people who are under the old covenant. Their sign and seal is the Sabbath and circumcision. And yeah, is that fair to say? Is everybody okay with that? I mean, the differences are there in the text. They exist. So I'm just pointing them out. No, my point is, so he blew a trumpet. And after he blows this trumpet, which is obviously a call to war, right away, the tribes are coming to him. These northern tribes that are in his area are gathering to him because he's standing up like a leader and he's blowing the trumpet. And they, of course, are anxious to be done with the constant incursion of the Midianites coming in and stealing their animals and their grain and everything. So finally, someone's rallying to war. Now, he's got an army. And yet, goes to God and says, "Are you sure?" See, that's why I said it's not a straight linear line here. It's moments of victory and moments of, "Are you sure?" So he's got an army gathered to him. Then Gideon said to God, "If you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken, Look at that, by the way. He even knew that God had spoken it. He knew the word of God. This is what you've said, God. But if you mean what you've said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool, which basically is a skin of a sheep with the wool still on it. I'm going to put the wool on the threshing floor, and if there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me as you have spoken. Okay, I know you said it, but I need some kind of tangible proof. So here's what we're going to do. Do you know what a threshing floor is? Threshing floor is usually up off the ground, and it has a grid underneath it, sort of a screen work underneath it, and it's where they would take the grain. When they had plucked the grain, it would have a husk around it, and the good meat of the grain would be inside the husk. And so they would lay the grain on the threshing floor and beat it. And by the way, the Latin word for that kind of beating, to separate the wheat from the chaff, I guess is the good phrase. That beating is the Latin word tribulum, from which we get tribulation. And so that's that beating thing for the purpose of separation. I just threw that in because it's interesting. Little extra freebie there. And that process then would separate the good meat from the husk. And then as the wind blew, since it was up off the ground, as the wind blew, they would throw the husk and the meat up into the air, and the meat would get caught by the grid, and the husks would fall away as they were being beaten apart and stuff. So it's above ground, and dew is going to gather. If you put wool, which is definitely going to attract dew, if you put it right there on an open screen above the ground and the dew falls, it's definitely going to get caught by the wool. Definitely. So he says, so here's what we're going to do. If I come out in the morning and there's dew in the wool, but none on the ground, then I will believe that you spoke to me and that you're going to definitely deliver me. Actually, I want to restate that, because he doesn't have any question that God spoke to him, because he's even talking back to him. He has no question that it was God and that God spoke. What he's questioning is whether he's the guy. He's questioning whether he's the one that's going to deliver Israel. It's just too big for him to conceive of. Verse 38 starts, and it was so. That happened. He went out the next day when he arose, early the next morning, and he squeezed out the fleece. He drained the dew from the fleece, a whole bowl full of water. And the ground was dry. Now that should have been the moment at which Gideon said to the army, come on, God's with us. Let's go get the trumpets, get the swords. We're winning this one. Let's go. Verse 39 then says, then Gideon said to God, don't let your anger burn against me. In other words, I know this is likely to upset you. After all, you spoke to me. You told me what to do. My response was to put you to the test. You answered the test. I want to ask you one more thing, okay? Just don't be angry. Just don't be angry. Do not let thine anger burn against me that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground. And I just find verse 40, the opening phrase, absolutely fascinating and reassuring, because it says, and God did so that night. God doesn't even argue with him. Why? Why wouldn't God argue? Admit it. Conrad, if it was you, you'd argue. You'd go, hey, I did it once, okay? One is good, okay? Did you forget the whole angel thing? You would think, yes, yes, any human being would go, I've given you all the evidence I'm going to give you. God doesn't argue with him. He doesn't contend with him. He doesn't say, O ye of little faith. Isn't that interesting? Jesus walked around on the planet, and whenever his apostles would come and say, you know, like, we couldn't drive out this particular demon. He didn't say, oh, I know, that one only comes out by prayer and fasting. He started with, oh, you of little faith. If you had faith as much as a mustard seed, which was the smallest seed there in the Middle East, he said, if you even had that much faith, You would say to a mountain to remove itself, and it would move out into the middle of the sea. If you had even a mustard seed of faith, that would happen. This was not him encouraging people to have faith and move mountains, which is the way it's so often preached, you know, have that mountain-moving faith. It's not at all what Jesus was saying. He was castigating them for their utter lack of faith and saying, if you even had the tiniest morsel of faith, you could move a mountain. Which, by the way, when he comes back, his foot touches the Mount of Olives, and it moves, splits in the middle, separates, because Jesus moves mountains, because he has faith. He is the one who could speak to a tree that wasn't bearing fruit and say, you're dead, and that tree died. This is the one who walks on water. That takes some faith. And by the way, when Jesus was walking on the water, as long as we're talking about examples of faith, and Peter said, Lord, if it is you, bid me to come to you. And Jesus says, yeah, come on. He steps out of the boat, and there's waves and storm going on. I mean, put shoe leather on this for a moment, no pun intended. But you're out there in a boat, in the storm, in the waves, the wind's whipping up. You know that people die all the time in this circumstance. And in the midst of the storm and the wind and the waves and the everything else, there's a guy walking on the water. Of course, it says they were afraid. They thought maybe it was a ghost. They didn't know what they were seeing. He finally gets close enough, they recognize it as him. And we also read that he walked as if he would have just gone right by them, which I find funny. They're out there toiling and rowing and crying that they're going to die. And he's just going to the other side. He's just walking. He just happened to walk past them. So there they have this conversation. Peter gets out, and as long as he's looking to Christ, he's on top of the waves. And then there's a very interesting Greek word where Jesus says, why did you doubt? And it's actually the Greek word that means double think. Why did you think again? You had it. You were walking right to me. You're walking on the waves, man. You are walking. But it says that he got his eyes off Christ and he looked at the waves. And he saw the wind and the waves and he began to double think. He began probably thinking, this isn't possible. I can't be here doing this. And it says, as soon as he did that, he began sinking. And then he cried out, Lord, save me. And it says, Jesus instantly, immediately, as soon as he said, Lord, save me, immediately reached out, took him by the hand, and he was up on the waves again. In other words, focus on Christ, and that's faith. Get your eyes off Christ. Think about something else. Second thought, you sink. Well, this is what Gideon's going through. Gideon's got that faith. It's working. I'm all right. I'm a double think. Hang on just a minute. And God goes along with him. He says, all right, if it's going to take two examples, I'll give you two examples. And I just love that God would do that. So Gideon said to God, don't let your anger burn. Let's do this one more time. And God did it. It was dry on the fleece, and there was dew on all the ground. Chapter 7, verse 1 says, then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, now we know who he's speaking of, and all the people who were with him rose up early and camped beside the spring of Harod, and the camp of Midian was on the north side of them by the hill of Moreh in the valley. And the Lord said to Gideon, the people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands. He's building his faith. I mean, after all, if he went in with a big army and they beat Midian, then they'd say, well, we did it. We got out there and we fought. Now, if I'm Gideon and I'm heading for war, I want as many people as possible with me. In fact, I'd like to intimidate Midian by the size of my army. I'd like them to see me coming and say, oh, we are definitely in trouble. Look at the size of the army that Jim has brought with him. That's a good way to enter a battle. So God goes to Gideon and says, too many. Because God's intention, as always, is to glorify himself. How many times have you heard me say, you could repeat it verbatim, I'm sure, God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. And he's going to get glory out of this. And if there's too many men, the men will think they did it. So, the ones that you have with you are too many. They're too many for me to give Midian into their hands, lest Israel become boastful, saying, my own power has delivered me. Now, therefore, come and proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart to Mount Gilead. That's amusing. I'm sorry. Okay, we're marching into war. Here we go. There's the Midianites. They have been beating up on us for years. But let's go fight them. Come on, guys. And so everybody's joining in. They've heard the trumpet. They get in. And Midian goes out and says, you know, if anybody's afraid, it's okay if you want to go home. And 22,000 people bugged out. Thousand soldiers said, you know, I am afraid, now that you mention it. I'm going to go.
I wasn't afraid until you said something.
Exactly. I was feeling kind of brave up till this moment, but since you bring it up. Now, 22,000 people returned and 10,000 remained, which means he started out with 32,000. Well, that's a pretty good size. You got 32,000 troops behind you. That looks like a pretty significant army marching across the valley. God breaks it down to a third. It says 22,000 are gone, 10,000 are what you get. Okay, good God, I can do it with 10,000. We'll do it with 10,000. That's what we're going to do, 10,000. But you're with us, God, so 10,000 and you know, we win. This is good. And then God comes back and says, nope, still too many. Then the Lord said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. Therefore, it shall be that he of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, then he shall go with you. But every one of whom I say, this one shall not go with you, he shall not go with you. That's election. That's God picking and choosing. Out of 10,000, he's going to pick 300. Out of 10,000, he's going to narrow it down to 300. And he's very clear to say to Gideon, now look, unless I tell you, you can have this one, you can't have them. So don't start counting off ones I didn't count, and don't start recruiting ones that I told to leave. So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, you will separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels down to drink. In other words, when we get to the river here, they all get a drink. Those that lower their eyes and put their mouth into the water, those can all go home. The ones that cup the water, eyes up and drink, you get to have them. And providentially, 300 did it the way God said, take them. Now, I'm asked sometimes, in fact, I was just asked this week, I think it was on one of the videos that's on YouTube about free will. Someone asked, yes, I get it, we don't have free will, but is God's predestinary will even involved in things like whether I choose to drink a Coke or a Pepsi? Is it even involved there? Well, as I said this past Sunday, the lot is cast into the lap, and the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. Every sparrow that falls out of the sky does so with God's attention. But here, it came down to how you drink. And the 300 who drank the way God approved, they're going to go into the battle. And the ones who got down on their hands and knees and lapped like dogs, they don't get to go. So, now the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, see, they would scoop up the water, drink like that. The ones who did that were 300 men. Wasn't that lucky? Just happened to be 300. What if the majority had done that? Well, they didn't, because God is in charge. But all the rest of the people kneeled down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and will give the Midianites into your hand. So let all the other people go, each man to his home. So now you've gotten rid of another 9,700 men. He said, sorry, you can't go with us. I know I blew the trumpet, and I know you came. And I know that when I said, if you're afraid, leave, you didn't leave. And now you got to go. Why, Gideon? No, because you knelt down to drink. God said, that doesn't work. You got to go home now. Isn't that interesting? These are people who are actually willing and brave to go to the fight, and God says, you don't get to go. Because I know that if I use 10,000, you'll even become braggadocious and think you did it. I'm going to take 300 men, and I'm going to save Israel by the 300. Amazing. Now, this requires, this is our theme tonight, this requires Gideon to have faith. Gideon at this moment has got to trust God. I mean, yeah, you got 300, but come on, you're going up against the armies of Midian. They're going to squash you. And yet, after Gideon goes all the way over to, come on, do this with the fleece, and then do this with the fleece again. After all his time of saying, let's do it again, let's do it again, let's do it again, God puts him in this situation where the only way he's going to succeed is to be completely trusting God to deliver him. It's going to require absolute faith. The same way that he tested God and kept putting God to the test, now God's putting him to the test, saying, this is what it's going to take out of you to do what I require of you. Now remember, it's not a straight linear line. Even when they get to the camp, God's going to give him yet another faith builder. Let's get through that part of the story and we'll call it an evening. Verse 7 of chapter 7 of the book of Judges, and the Lord said to Gideon, I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and will give the Midianites into your hands. So let all the other people go, each man to his home. So the 300 men took the people's provisions and their trumpets into their hands. And Gideon sent all the other men of Israel, each to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. Now in that same night, it came about that the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hands. In other words, everybody in that camp, I've given them to you. But if you are afraid, go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp, and you will hear what they say. And afterward, your hands will be strengthened so that you may go down against the camp. So he went with Purah, his servant, down to the outposts of the army that was in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the sons of the east were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number, as numerous as the sands of the seashore. What the writer here is trying to tell you is he's vastly outnumbered. He's only got the 300, and they're like locusts in the valley. When Gideon came, says verse 13, behold, a man was relating a dream to a friend. Okay, now think about it. All God said was, okay, now there's as many people down there as locusts. Take your servant, go into the camp. He takes his servant and goes down into the camp, and just happens coincidentally to show up in the exact place where two guys are talking, and one tells the other about a dream he had the night before. That means God is in charge of the dream. That means God is in charge of these two Midianites who are talking. That means that God timed the conversation in such a way that it only happened when Gideon was there. It means that God knew what the conversation and the dream were going to be about, and that they were going to say this exact thing, because he said to Gideon, when you go there, you're going to hear something that's going to strengthen your hand. So God knew what the conversation was, when it was going to take place, who was going to have the conversation. And this was all among the enemies of Israel who don't know God. That's sovereignty. And so, when Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend. And he said, behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent, and it struck it so that it fell, and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. And his friend answered and said, okay, now here's his friend interpreting the dream and somehow interprets it this way. This is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into the hand of Gideon. How did he know that? This is an enemy. This is a Midianite. This is not an Israelite. This is not a God-fearer. And yet, he interpreted a dream. Look, I saw barley bread roll downhill, hit the tent, turn it upside down, and it's empty. What do you think that means? That means Gideon's coming. How do you know this? What a peculiar interpretation that was. But as he gives that interpretation, verse 15, it came about that when Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, that he bowed in worship. And he returned to the camp of Israel. And he said, arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands. There's the faith. Now, how did he get to the faith? Through tests, trials, questions, doubt, God reassuring him, God being patient with him, God building him up, God taking him along the process of building and encouraging his faith, because after all, he is both the author of faith, but also the finisher, perfecter of it. So it's not just that he gives you faith, but then in your lifetime, he perfects that faith he gives you. And the way he perfects that faith is through the events and the trials of this life that he takes you through to develop you into the person he has determined you are going to become. And you're going to become that because you're in the hands of an absolutely sovereign God who is doing that for his glory and your benefit. And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and he put trumpets and empty pitchers into the hands of all of them, with torches inside the pitchers. And he said to them, look at me and do what I do. And behold, when I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I and all who are with me blow the trumpet, then you also blow the trumpets all around the camp and say, for the Lord and for Gideon. Why would he throw his own name in there? Because the interpretation said that God was with Gideon and that Gideon's going to beat up on the camp. So they're scared of Gideon. They're scared of the God of Gideon, but they know the leader of the camp that's coming to get them is this Gideon guy. So say, for the Lord and for Gideon. So Gideon and the 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch when they had just posted the watch. And they blew the trumpets and they smashed the pitchers that were in their hands. And when the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the pitchers, they held the torches in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands for blowing. And they cried, a sword for the Lord and for Gideon. Now, just so you understand it, they took their torches, which had their fire in it, and they put them in pitchers so that it would be darkened so that they could sneak up on the edges of the camp without being realized. Then they surrounded the camp, broke the pitchers, all of a sudden the camp is lit up. There's torches all the way around the camp. There's trumpets blowing, and there's men yelling, the sword of the Lord and Gideon. The camp of the Midianites think they're outnumbered. They're surrounded. So this is what happens. And each stood in his place around the camp, and all the army ran, crying out as they fled. And when they blew 300 trumpets, the Lord set the sword of one against another, even throughout the whole army. And the army fled as far as Beth Shittah, toward Zererah, and as far as the edge of Abel Meholah by Tabeth. And the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali and Asher and all Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. In other words, there was so much confusion in the camp that when they saw the light and heard the trumpets and heard about Gideon, they started killing each other. In other words, God threw them into confusion. Gideon didn't even have to fight. Okay, so all the way back to the wine press, mighty man of valor. What does it take for him to be the mighty man of valor? Just watch God. Just watch God deliver Israel. Watch God deliver Israel by 300 men against an army that's like locusts in the valley. Watch God cause confusion in such a way that they will kill each other and flee, and you, Midian, don't even have to fight. Just do what I tell you to do, and I'll fight for you. And then you get the reputation as the mighty man of valor, because you, by faith, did what I required of you to do. In other words, just follow God, follow hard on his heels, do what he says to do, he'll fight for you, and it'll work out to your benefit. It's the same story all the way through the Bible. It's just exemplified in the person of Gideon. And then, fascinatingly, once they're on the run, who does he call? All those guys who went back to their tents. All the ones who said, no, we're scared, we're going home, we're good. All the ones who got down on their hands and knees to drink and all had to go home. Now that the Midianites are fleeing, he calls them all and says, have at it. Rout them now. So the men of Israel were summoned from Naphtali and Asher and all Manasseh, and they pursued Midian. And Gideon sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, come down against Midian and take the waters before them, as far as Beth-barah and the Jordan. And all the men of Ephraim were summoned, and they took the waters as far as Beth-barah and all of Jordan. In other words, they captured all that land around the rivers and had access again to the water. And they captured the two leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And they killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and they killed Zeeb at the winepress of Zeeb. While they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon from across the Jordan. I, by the way, like the great irony of God, I do think it's ironic and wonderful that they killed Zeeb at the winepress of Zeeb. The winepress of Zeeb used to be a place full of wine, because after all, he'd stolen it all from Israel. And meanwhile, over on the other side, there's this other winepress where there's this poor guy with the last of his grain, hiding in the wine press. God gets a hold of him, calls him mighty man of valor, teaches him how to be faithful, and then routs the armies of Midian so that all of Ephraim gets to come and fight and chase him off. They get their land back, they get their water back, and the king, who previously had the full wine press, dies there. And the one who was hiding in the wine press is now exactly what God determined he was going to be, the mighty man of valor. Isn't that a great story?
Yep.
Don't tell me that the Old Testament's not relevant to the day in which we live. Same God, still alive, doing the same stuff, still working the same way. The God of the Old Testament is still the God in heaven today, doing the same things. And he was faithful to Gideon, and he'll be faithful to you. And if he has called you, if he has chosen, elected you, he's going to teach you faith. And he's going to author that faith in you, and then he's going to perfect that faith in you, and he's going to teach you how to be faithful. Because, after all, in the end, your faith, which he gives you and which he develops in you, becomes the trading commodity in heaven that you get to trade for righteousness. And in the book of Galatians, Paul reaches all the way back to Abraham and says, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. And then he argues to the Galatians that if they'll just have faith, that will become their righteousness. I say over and over and over and over and over again, and over again, and over again, and over again. And I'll say it yet again now. Absolutely everything necessary for our full, complete redemption and salvation is a gift from God, from start to finish. From him choosing us, to him giving us the faith and the repentance, to him perfecting us forever. The whole spectrum of everything necessary, he does, and then the faith he gives you and perfects, he trades for righteousness, so that you stand before him without spot or blemish or wrinkle, and he did it all. And that's the gospel in the Old Testament. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Lord, hasten the day when my faith becomes sight.
Lord, hasten the day when my faith becomes sight. Yeah, absolutely. I might break out into song there, but I won't. Any questions about that? Good. Are you glad you were here?
Good stuff.
It's good stuff. All right, you get 2 weeks off. I'll see you here January 4th, but I'll see you here this Sunday. There's no food this Sunday. I know. I ate well on Sunday, didn't you all?
Oh, my.
Man, it was great. Well, we'll see you here Sunday. Any questions? Anything else? Great.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.